Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992 here from our perch in 2024. I'm one of your hosts, Phyllis Gove.
I'm your special guest host, Emily St. James, sitting in for your regular host, my dead name. I have taken his place because girls are better at podcasting.
And soccer, I think, yeah. Right? I mean, sure.
No, yeah, I think I screwed up the metaphor there, but you know what I meant. We're talking about ladybugs.
Yeah.
So I'm getting out ahead of it. I'm being transphobic about myself. And
I can't wait for the queer phobia scale on this movie, Emily.
It's a negative three because this movie loves trans people.
With us today, LaToya Ferguson, TV writer, critic, co-host of The Empire Diaries, is here to talk with us about ladybugs.
I am here. Some people didn't seem that excited to talk about this movie for some reason. So we'll get to the bottom of it, really.
We will get to the bottom of that. I do want to say right off the bat that I'm sorry. And I say this just because LaToya has joined us for two films. The 1999 film, The Other Sister, and the 1992 film, Ladybugs. LaToya, you're going to get the cream of the crop in the next iteration, I promise you.
I don't believe him until it happens, honestly.
I want to be clear. We went out to Jamel Bowie and he was like, can I have ladybugs?
We were like, no, you
can't have
ladybugs. Wanted it. And we were like, and Unforgiven is a better.
Yeah, we went out to Griffin Newman. He said, I got to take ladybugs. Yeah. We went out to the president of the United States, Joseph Robinette Biden. He said, I want ladybugs. He was like, no, LaToya's on that. And he's like, well, I'm not coming on the show.
So we did fight for you is ultimately what we're saying here. Here's the thing. I think I had some knowledge this movie existed, like just in the kind of the osmosis of being alive when it came out, working at video stores, what have you. I don't really know Rodney Dangerfield, and I'm assuming, LaToya, that he's a personal friend of yours.
A good buddy, Rodney.
You're a good buddy. But it does feel like you have. Have you seen some of his movies?
I mean, there's not a huge oeuvre, but I've seen like the big ones, which are, of course, Ladybugs and Back to School.
Go back to school. I've heard that he goes back
to school. That's the thing he does in that movie.
Starring Academy Award winner Robert Downey Jr. Wow. He is in that movie. Wow.
Because
this movie is very important to my childhood, as I let you know before the podcast, but my childhood like favorite actor actually was not Rodney Dangerfield. It was Robert Downey Jr. The number of times I've seen Heart and Souls is more than this movie. Yeah.
So I watched Heart and Souls, I want to say probably in the last like 5-6 months. Mm-hmm. And I had seen that film. I vividly remember, I used to go to summer camp, obviously, and every summer when my mom would pick me up from the the buses or whatever, at the end of summer, she'd take me to like her favorite movie of the summer, if it was theaters. And she told me to see Heart and Souls, and she loved it, and I loved it, and it became like kind of the staple for us. It holds up. It's still a great movie.
I would watch that all the time as a kid too. So I wasn't just watching Ladybugs all the time. So I had a balance in terms of my taste level and what I was exposed to.
When did RDJ get his hooks in you? What was the movie that was it Heart and Souls?
Well, just because he kind of was always around in the household. So he's in Heart and Souls. He's in Weird Science. He's in Soap Dish. Like, these movies were always like playing in my home, basically. Like, young RDJ. Which is it? Is he in Chances Are? Or
he is.
Yeah,
he is.
That one. That was a big one. That was a big one in our house too. Yeah.
We did that on our 89 Patreon. A weird movie.
It really is. But yeah, but a lot of 80s movies are, and that's part of the appeal, is it not?
Yeah. 100%. I mean,
I like him so sad we can't cover Heart and Souls, because that movie's good. I mean, obviously we could. We could just do a one-off episode like we did for...
So do whatever you want. It's your podcast.
Leprechaun. But no, like, that is like a totemic film for
great
Libby.
Movie.
For my
that
wife.
Could be the one good movie I'm on.
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
Before I go back to the bad movies.
It is one of those films that I, as I said, I watched relatively recently, and I was really surprised that it didn't hit a little better than it did. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't think it should have been some huge success or what have you, but like, it does feel like when it comes out, a movie like that could have performed, and I was a little surprised that it didn't. But on the Rodney Dangerfield of it all, Emily, have you seen Caddyshack?
I've seen like parts of Caddyshack.
Okay.
So what would happen when I was growing up in my terrible household is we would go on vacation, and there would be HBO in those hotel rooms, and like, my father would watch small snippets of movies that we were not allowed to watch at home, and I would catch him watching that. And that is how I've seen probably 30 minutes of Caddyshack scattered across the entire film. But I could not say with any confidence that I have seen Caddyshack, even though I've seen like most of the good bits.
Yeah,
I've seen clips of it as well. I've never sat down and pressed play on it and watched it, you know, with intent. I think I've surmised its tone and its kind of what it's doing, and it's just not really my tempo. And I don't say that to be shitty. I just mean like that movie is a staple of a certain genre of comedy. It's just not really my thing. But I'm assuming you've seen it, LaToya?
No, I'm also in bits. That was not in the rotation in my household.
Okay, fair enough.
I think also for the same reasons. It's just like it for who it hits, and for everyone else. Sure. We've only seen clips, so.
I do think, though, Emily, that Rover Dangerfield could be your personality.
listen, I like, okay, so if the fascist state takes hold and they outlaw all trans existence,
sure.
Obviously, the thing I'm going to do is, like, you know, just continue living my life. But when I have to make public appearances, I'm just going to do Rodney Dangerfield cosplay. that's like a thing I could do. I could be like, oh, well, my wife told me that I needed to go outside, and I said, why don't you go outside, huh? Climb a tree or something. That's my Rodney Dangerfield.
Terrible.
It has to be insulting himself, though.
Yeah, it does.
It's true.
I'll think of some good one-liners while we do this.
Like interstitial throughout the podcast. It's just you like workshopping your Rodney Dangerfield bits.
You know what's interesting is that I can't seem to find any box office results for Rover Dangerfield. Curious as to how that movie did. Have you seen Rover Dangerfield?
I have not, no. I am aware of it, but I have not.
So just because it's worth stating that, you know, obviously Rodney Dangerfield was a pretty significant stand-up comedian in the 50s and 60s. I mean, he built quite a name for himself. And Caddyshack is sort of the thing that puts him on the map in terms of movies. He does a film called Easy Money, which I have not seen, which came out in 83, which, again, I think was, I mean, this cast, Joe Pesci, Jennifer Jason Leigh. Interesting. That being said, he does that. Then Back to School is 86, and Back to School made $100 million. So Danny Elfman did the score. It was just a big hit. And I think that that kind of gave people the feeling that like Rodney could kind of do no wrong. But then Rover Dangerfield, mm-hmm. which again, I cannot find any.
Like looking at the poster, I'm sure we watched it on VHS at one point in my childhood, but like it was not something that was, I don't think I latched onto it the way I latched onto Ladybugs.
You know when people get mad at the New York Times for like mm-hmm. inflating like the mm-hmm. faults of Biden versus like, you know, sure. Trump's an imminent dictatorial takeover? Phil is like that about Rover Dangerfield's box office. He's like, the press has failed us. Where the fuck is this box office info?
Well, a little bit, but I'm also just, I'm more than anything, a little bit, I'm more just surprised. Like, it's very rare that you find a movie online that has no, like, box office results.
What did it even, so here's my question. Did it actually come out in theaters? Did it, like, have a, like or did it have,
it
like, a
novelty? It does look like it
release?
Did. It has,
yes, because. The release date says it was August 1991 and home video is February 1992. So it had to have come out.
It was 74 minutes long.
Yeah.
So it's the perfect length.
Okay. So there's
Harold Ramis co-wrote it.
There's 6 critics reviews of this film on Rotten Tomatoes, which suggests that either A, it was not screened for critics, or B, mm-hmm. it was released in just like a handful of theaters and dumped as a contractual obligation, in which case
I
would. In either case, I'm not surprised there's no box office info because it was probably so far down the charts
sure.
that sites like Box Office Mojo don't really have access to that information because it's. There's this weird, we've talked about this, there's this weird line in 1995 that it's like before that it becomes much harder to get reliable 100%. Movie mm-hmm. info. And Rover Dangerfield is famously a 1991 film. Everybody knows that.
I want to, Emily, the taglines for Rover Dangerfield because I feel like it's something that's going to speak to you.
Should I have watched Rover Dangerfield before
that's
I came here?
That's what this
here?
Show's about, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you think it was about ladybugs? You'll laugh, you'll sing, you'll dance, you'll sit up and beg for more, the
okay.
dog who gets no respect.
Okay.
And then it says, Rodney Dangerfield is Rover, a big city hound who trades bright lights for barnyard laughs.
That sounds good.
I'm telling you, this might be your personality.
Now that I have discovered Rodney Dangerfield, my mansona, I'm like very excited to watch Rover Dangerfield.
I'm going to give a little bit of context for Ladybugs. The Google synopsis for this movie is chef's kiss. Desperate for success, girls football coach Chester finds a novel way to bolster his failing team. He includes his own stepson disguised as a girl. Full stop. Which is not inaccurate. Ladybugs opened on March 27th, 1992 against White Men Can't Jump, Basic Instinct, Wayne's World, My Cousin Vinny, and of course the Mighty Ducks. It would go on to make $14 million on a $20 million budget. That's not nothing, guys. $14 million. Like they definitely shouldn't have spent $20 million on this movie, but $14 million hard-earned American dollars went to this movie. It has 16.16% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 43% from audiences. The Los Angeles Times wrote that the film flip-flops on its themes and has the stale, slick, worked-over look of a standard studio project, whatever the fuck that means. And then the New York Times said, even when the material is feeble, as it is here, Mr. Dangerfield can sometimes be funny. The lowest bar.
That's like when I used to review Last Man Standing week to week at the AV Club. I would be like, you know what? Sometimes these people are funny.
Oh, it's so good. I mean, this was when I hit play on this, I really had no expectations outside of the fact that I knew this was part of LaToya's DNA.
Part of my DNA.
I didn't really know much about it. And immediately I was hit with I don't really get the Rodney Dangerfield thing. But LaToya, it seems as though for you as a kid, that didn't kind of matter, right? Like, or
it's one of those things where it's just one of those, like, here's this old guy who has a stick and it's the 90s. And I guess we all just accept that. I wasn't really even Like, Rodney Dangerfield's so funny. Besides, you know, no respect. That's funny, right? This guy doesn't get respect. I think for me and my watching, which, by the way, watching, I watched it this morning beforehand. I don't know how I didn't know the movie was PG-13. Because I guess I just assumed it was PG. And then I was watching, I'm like, nope. Don't know how. I didn't remember any of that. But specifically, yeah, so it's PG-13. And again, I don't know how I was watching this. But so the real draws for, I think, were like a fun, you know, kids sports movie, because 1992 also the Mighty Ducks. There's also, the beautiful, Jonathan Brandis,
and R.I.P.
Exactly. He's so pretty in this movie, not pretty enough to really pull off the Martha thing, especially since he only does a fake voice once in one scene. But it's, listen, I was never like, oh, and Jack A is, love Jack A.
She's great, but I feel like she's in a different movie.
It's like she should be. It should be her movie. She should be the coach of Ladybugs.
100%.
100%. Oh, that's such a good idea. And then Rodney Dangerfield should be the evil other coach who comes in the last 30 minutes. That he would have gotten an Oscar nomination for that. I guarantee you.
But that is something. If she has her ragtag team, which I love. Even as a kid, I loved a ragtag team. You know, those are always fun. And then Jack Hayes. Somehow, Jackie knows nothing about sports. She likes to shop. She loves men. She's Jackie.
I do need to say, though, because you brought up the sort of the sports movie trope,
right?
which is definitely very much a thing, that this movie in no way executes.
Oh, like, it executes in the last game, finally. They execute that part in the last game.
It's when she's telling her, to me.
The girl to psych him out, I'm like, how is this just now happening in this scene?
I was watching it just being like, because when I hit play, I was like, you know, at least this thing will have bearing walls of a sports movie that, like, at least I can be invested in the team to some degree. But it doesn't even give you that. It kind of, there are some players that have kind of arcs, but fundamentally where the sort of season is and where they fit in the hierarchy of this league is completely just, they did yada yada right over them.
As an expert on youth girls soccer,
genuinely,
I know more about how good the Yellow Jackets are than I do how good the Ladybugs. And the Yellow Jackets play soccer for, I want to be clear, one episode. Then they're like killing each other. So I mean,
Yellow Jackets is more successful at soccer than this.
It really
It seems that the Ladybugs, all the good players, they aged out of this. And instead of just trying to change, you know, someone's birth certificate, they do this.
Yeah.
It is really kind of, it is just interesting, I guess, because they have this, for lack of a better way of putting it, a fallback structurally and from a screenplay perspective, which is the sports movie. And it really could have kind of ballast and kind of given the movie something to hold on to. And the conscious choice to not do that is a level of incompetency that's hard to wrap my head around.
One thing I think is, fascinating is the word, but so basically in terms of creating the premise, it's Jonathan Brandis' character Matthew gets kicked off both JV football and soccer because, like, he's just cares so much about sports that he's not focusing on his schooling, right? And so then when he has, like, his first scene, like, as Martha, it's like, oh, you're kind of like a bad teammate, right? So they basically make that his thing instead of the academics, because when he tells his mom, oh, I'm on a new team, it's like, you shouldn't be on any team. The point was the academics. Mm-hmm. But now, then they just switch it to, he would know he was a bad teammate. That's why he got kicked off, basically.
It is, I mean,
he's also a king jock who can't talk to a girl.
Which is, that's we will talk about that. But I want to kind of hone in for a second here on, we've talked about this a little bit, Emily, of the 90s still being kind of a hangover from the 80s, 92 still feeling like a hangover from the 80s.
Uh-huh.
And this definitely has that residue of like 80s comedy.
This feels like they just made a Porky's movie and we're like, let's just do a Porky's throwback. And then someone was like, we don't have the rights to Porky's. And it slowly evolved into whatever this is.
Because there's a part of me that's like, the highest stakes in this movie is if someone's going to find out that Matthew's dressing up like a girl. Mm-hmm. That is the pinnacle of stakes within the context of this film.
But apparently, that was not.
That was, that was the pinnacle of steaks for me when I was 12 too. So
I mean, touche. I mean, fair. But sorry, what did you say, Latoya?
Well, those high stakes aren't even really high stakes because no one gets upset about it. And even his fiance is like, I forgive you, but I forgave you off screen, I guess.
Like, I just want to say a thing up front here. I laughed at this movie a lot. Like, yeah, I frequently laughed. My wife thought I was having a mental health episode. Because at the end of the film, I applauded because I found the end of the film so fucking audacious and stupid that I couldn't help but clap. It just like, just it like is. Rodney Dangerfield trying to save this terrible movie by tanking his on-screen persona entirely. But I think I'll talk more about this throughout the episode, but like, sure. this is a movie about the trans sports panic, but also just really everybody's like, well, of course, if you could get a boy on a girl's team, that's what you would do. Like, that's just a great strategy.
Yeah, it's a ringer. Yeah, I mean, it's crazy.
There's no reason for the panic because they all accept it. So actually, it is, it's woke.
Yeah, it's woke. It's very woke.
It's a woke movie. I mean, it is interesting though, because if you look at sort of, this is the end of, I mean, it's the 1-2 punch of Rover Dangerfield and Ladybugs that really ends Rodney Dangerfield's movie career. The next thing he does is the thing I kind of know him most for, which is his role in Natural Born Killers in 1994. Also with Robert Downey Jr., where he plays the incestuous father in this weird sort of sitcom send up thing that they're doing, which I actually think is effective in. And then, you know, he obviously has a bunch of like straight to video things and what have you. And, you know, that's kind of it. But it is interesting what you're saying, Emily, about this idea of like Rodney Dangerfield trying to round the edges off of a somewhat aggressive persona. But it's so incongruent to like, you really, it's just not really possible.
I know that we haven't gone through the plot, but I want to just dissect the last 5 minutes of this film, please. Which I think explains everything about comedy.
Oh my God.
No. So the movie is like, okay, so Jonathan Brandis is Martha. He's playing as a girl. He's falling for his friend Kimberly. Then he reveals the secret, or his mom figures out the secret. He can't be on the team anymore. The plot of the movie is that then he has to inspire the girls through big heartwarming speech. They win the game, even though he's not on the team. And Rodney Dangerfield realizes, I guess it's not, you know, it's not worth cheating to stay ahead.
But still gets the promotion.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So the coda of this film is he's on a bus with a bunch of like 12-year-old boys, and he's like, they're dressed up like baseball players. You're like, oh, it's a baseball game. And he's like, we're going to go out there and you're going to win and you're going to run like men because you are men. And they get off the bus, and who should he run into but the coach of the other team, who is a legendary baseball coach. I think 3-time World Series winner, right? Tommy Lasorda, Los Angeles hero, who at that time was like the most famous baseball coach. And he's like, I heard that you had a boy play as a girl on your soccer team. And Rodney Dangerfield's like, no, you can't possibly say that. And then the boss comes up and is like, you know, also saying the same thing. And then you cut, they say all of this. Then you cut over. All of these 12-year-old boys have dressed up like girls, and they're a softball team, and they're going to play softball. Again, this is very woke because everyone's okay with it, except nobody notices this is happening. It's just like the easiest thing in the world to get past themselves. And then the boss is like, well, Chester, that's the name of Rodney Dangerfield's character, which they say a billion times. You got the girl. You got the job. Seems like things are really great for you. Rodney Dangerfield says, I guess you're right. He turns to camera and says, I finally got some respect. Freeze frame on his bug-eyed face. Roll credits. Over the credits, they play a song that liberally samples dialogue from the movie, including Rodney Dangerfield saying, I finally got some respect. I stood up and cheered. This film is like a masterpiece of incompetence. It just is. There's something
I
in
agree
it
with that.
That song has been in my head for all these years since I first saw the movie.
It's like, yes.
I will say though, it is in a weird way too. Like, there's nowhere to go as Rodney Dangerfield from here, right? If his whole shtick is I don't get respect,
that's exactly it.
It's over.
But the story arc of this film makes no sense. The way in which it's like Rodney Dangerfield being like, I guess I'm done with movies now, is perfect. And then he like goes on to his next thing, which is like just playing the abusive dad in things.
Yep.
That's the next chapter.
It is interesting. So I don't know if you knew this, LaToya, but do you know who this film was originally offered to?
In terms of leaks, I know that for the Jack A role who they wanted, Whoopi.
Yeah,
it was Whoopi, yes. Yeah. But she chose sister act instead.
Indeed, which proved to be the smarter choice for obvious reasons. But I actually think that Whoopi and Rodney would not have actually worked and made sense. Like, that's...
Yeah.
Those are two kind of, you know, I don't want to say similar because they're not similar, but just like they're Whoopi's too big a star to play second fiddle to.
That's the version of the movie where Jack A or Whoopi is the lead and he's the rival. Yeah.
Right. I mean, Whoopi has an Oscar at this point, right? Like Whoopi is a big movie star. If you wanted to make a movie about Whoopi Goldberg has a soccer team mm-hmm. and she's the lead. I mean, I guess I could see that, I guess. I don't really know what that is, but sure. But I don't really understand it with her and Rodney together. It doesn't really make a ton of sense. I think ultimately my issue, I mean, I have lots of issues with this movie, but I do think that like, it's kind of a one joke movie. So it just gets tiresome for me where I'm just like, there's not enough there. And if you are going to remove the sports stuff, then I'm really unengaged. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's again, it's one joke said by Rodney Dangerfield for thankfully 90 minutes because I was like at a certain like it's getting exhausting. Like he's always on.
Yes, it's also this movie starts in a very bizarre way.
Yes,
it almost feels like you're in media res. And something's happened. Like it
starts as a more interesting movie. A more interesting dystopian movie. I want to know about.
But I even mean just in the execution of it, which is it literally just starts with random aerial shots of some anonymous city with pre-lap of an audio of what sounds like a cult of some sort. And you're just sort of like, what is...
I forgot about this.
Did they add this in reshoots?
Yeah, I'm like, what are we doing here?
It's a collective group of people who are there too.
Right, holding mirrors.
You got a punk rock chick there. Like, what?
If this takes place in a dystopia, then it makes more sense of why he's with a beautiful woman who's like 20 years younger than him. Because listen, there are men who can attract women 20 years younger than them. I totally buy that. I don't think Rodney Dangerfield is on that list anywhere.
The 14-year-old girl on the soccer team who has a crush on him. What about that?
This movie's insane. Peerless. But yes, if this is a dystopia, then I can assume that she has been assigned to him because her husband died, you know, or something.
Sure, sure, sure.
I will say this.
Yes.
Why does this movie need the cross-dressing element? If this movie is about Rodney Dangerfield has a new girlfriend and she has a daughter who's like rebellious because like her parents split up or her dad died or something, but she's really good at sports. And for some reason, his boss is like, you have to take over this soccer team because I want glory. Then like, he's like, well, actually I got this ringer. My future stepdaughter's amazing at sports. This movie would still like, I don't work is the wrong word, but yeah. there's like a better spine there than just like all the bits that are happening.
But obviously they thought it was funny for a boy to be in the dress because I read that it was between Jonathan Brandis and Leonardo DiCaprio for the role.
Oh my God.
Basically Leo was too convincing as a girl and it ruined the joke.
That's amazing.
He's fucking method, that guy. Like, you know what?
Love that so much.
That is, yeah. No, like there is the thing about it is Yeah, 12, like a boy this age, like doesn't take that much work to like dress up as a girl and make convincing. Like that first time you see Martha, you're like, I get why people buy this. And also, like, yeah, he doesn't do anything to modulate his voice, but like I've done very little to like actually modulate my voice. It's so much more about pitch and resonance and things like that, that like you don't realize are happening until you actively think about them. So like I also bought that, but it is very much like Jonathan Brandis is playing as the cliche of like the man in a dress who like stomps around and stuff, but it doesn't work with a 12-year-old boy. Leaving all the offensiveness aside, the Milton Berle thing doesn't work with a 12-year-old boy, because a 12-year-old boy, you dress him up like a girl and he inherently looks a little bit like a girl, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's I agree with you, Emily, that like
Leo would have won an Oscar is what I'm saying.
It is interesting because it's hard not to sort of think like if they want to soften Rodney Dangerfield, which to some degree feels like one of the things that they were trying to do with this movie. If you just gave him a girls' soccer team, right? Mm-hmm. And you remove this, you know, stepson dressing up thing, you can still have all of the like stupid jokes and you can still have all the Rodney Dangerfield stuff.
You can have a 14-year-old be horny for Rodney Dangerfield, which is what's truly important. Do whatever you want.
Right. I ultimately think that someone thought it needed some sort of a hook or a whatever. Yeah. And you're just like, this hook sucks.
Well, if it's a girl though, if she's in love with Vanessa Shaw, that's not funny. So
That's very moving and touching. I like this so much more, genuinely.
It is.
If it's like Rodney Dangerfield helping a young lesbian discover herself, like, I don't think that movie works at all, but like, I'm more interested in watching
it. It'd be a fascinating movie to go back to, that's for sure.
I mean,
I gotta say, people get scared when I'm attracted to girls too. It's fine.
There you go.
There's a scene pretty deep in this film. There. With Chester and, forgive me, I don't remember the character's name, this girl
Kimberly? Wait, Matthew or Kimberly?
Kimberly, mm-hmm. Where she wears glasses and her hair
Penny Pester, because they keep calling her Pester. It's like, call her Penny, you bullies.
Yeah. You fucking assholes. So he, you know, she takes she lets her hair down and
the original She's All That.
And she does a fucking, you know, Pygmalion nonsense and has this kind of, this scene that inherently is creepy because she seems to have some sort of a crush on him, and it's all kind of gross and weird on its face. But I do think that Rodney Dangerfield is capable of modulating and turning down the kind of manic insanity that is his persona to make the scene somewhat believable. Mm-hmm. That makes me see the movie you're talking about, Emily, of like, you know, where they do more of that, he can still do his like bug-eyed gross out shit here and there, whatever. But like, there's just a better movie. This movie's just fundamentally flawed because it's manic and it's jumping all over the place and it doesn't really pick a tone.
It's just like, it has a musical number at one point for no reason. Like, again, I sent Phil several texts about how I was laughing at this movie. And I think that he thought, A, I think he thought I was trolling him, which is partially true. But B, think that he was like, thought I was genuinely enjoying this film. And what I was really trying to do, just puzzle out my emotional reaction to this movie. Cause that's like, fair. I was laughing at it a lot and I was having a terrible time. Like, it was this weird.
I was not laughing and having a terrible time. I think ultimately, and I understand the wavelength that you got on. I also want to say too, LaToya, that I understand if I was a kid watching this movie.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's filled with like shit that kids would probably laugh at, right? Like, I don't know.
Yeah. It's funny. She's staring at the butterflies. You should be staring at the butterflies. You're supposed to be playing soccer.
But then you
they broke her nail.
The ball.
It's a good bit. It's a good bit.
Yeah. I like the thing is, though, is like this movie has been, I think, forgotten because this is the era of Disney just starting to crank out much better youth sports movies. None of which is like an AA movie, but all of which are like solid Bs. Like we watched Mighty Ducks for this. Mighty Ducks is so much better than this movie.
Mighty Ducks, solid B. It's not the A+ that D2 the Mighty Ducks is.
Of course. So.
Yeah.
And there's no one that dresses like Marguerite Moreau in this movie.
Oh, fuck. Marguerite Moreau's fashion. No, don't get me started.
Just get me started on Marguerite Moreau, honestly. Just finished my coverage of season 2 of The OC. She shows up.
It is one of those things where I did find myself at a certain point kind of fascinated by this artifact, if you will, right? Of being sort of neither fish nor fowl, to kind of your point, Emily, which is that it falls in this weird slipstream between these 80s kind of raunchy comedies that Rodney Dangerfield was a part of and this 90s Disney-ified sports kids movies. And it's kind of neither of those things. Yeah. So it's just nothing.
Yeah, I watched the trailer before watching the movie, and then then I saw the PG-13 and everything. But like, the trailer has the voiceover guy at one point say, "What he's willing to try could get him arrested." And I'm like, and they say it when he's having the idea to dress Matthew up. I'm like, that's never really a threat in the movie. But I was reading that Paramount was struggling to market the movie because, you know, of like Dangerfield, you know, more profane comic thing, with this being, you know, more kid like, obviously I was watching it as a kid, but like it being PG-13. And apparently Rover Dangerfield, when they were developing it, it was supposed to be like a hard R animated movie that Warner Brothers was like, nope, it's G now. So
which is insane. I mean, that is its own thing.
And this is like 92 is a big year for famously adult comedy stars building bridges to the kid audience, like Robin Williams in Aladdin and Ferngully is like, just like, he's trying to build that bridge. He successfully built it. 93 is Mrs. Doubtfire, which this movie walks so Mrs. Doubtfire could soar. But
I mean, Whoopi is an example of that as well. I mean, I think that, you know, Sister Act is that sort of bridge. I mean, you're absolutely right, Emily, that he just, it's clear what's trying to be achieved and why it's not working. I mean, there is a scene to me that sort of crystallizes all of the wrong instincts that this movie has, and it's the dressing room scene. Do you know what I'm talking about? Where there's a parent and child outside a dressing room. Rodney is in the dressing room with Jonathan Landis. And
Brandis,
my
not John Landis.
sorry. And it's implied that there's sex happening in there.
And yes, because every older woman is a delicate flower who is like,
sure. But like, that joke, like, you just have to ask yourself, that joke in this movie, who's it for, right? Like, what is the sort of bullseye that you're aiming for? And that's a bullseye that I think this movie is aiming for and misses pretty dramatically. It's strange. There's jokes in this film. There's an elevator scene where a white woman thinks that Jack A and Rodney Dangerfield are getting married. And there's this whole, like, her saying, hold your head up high. And there's like all this weird sort of like racial stuff that's there that you're just like, who's this for?
There is a thing that, like, watching these 90s movies and like digging into the political context around them. Like, one of the things I learned is that like a majority of people in the United States only became the number of people who supported interracial marriage only surpassed the number of people who didn't support it in the late 80s. So this is like a really new thing. It's like, see all these like social attitudes that at the time were like, the reason I do the queer phobia skills, because at the time everyone was like, well, the queer people, we can laugh at them, right? Like, that's fine. And it's just like, I don't know. It does get a bit numbing, you know, as you watch all this, and like there's these certain baked in assumptions about how the culture behaves that result in movies like Ladybugs.
It is. I mean, obviously I knew that I was watching a film that was made in 1992 and that, you know, perspective.
I don't know if this film made. I don't know if this film was made. I think it happened. I think this film arose from the ground.
It's from something. Yeah, it is interesting. You know, I want to sort of underline some of these jokes that exist in this film, of like Vanessa Shaw slow motion running in a bikini towards Jonathan Brandis, and him having this like dream sequence that I actually thought was the dream sequence was actually pretty funny to some degree. Their outfits were insane. This vision that of what this boy thinks is a perfect life with this girl is funny. And I do kind of wish that they leaned into that more of the crush on Kimberly, of this sort of Matthew's, what Matthew's going through. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, clearly he's grappling with the fact that his mother is marrying this new guy, like all that stuff. That's just not really, you know, they don't do anything with
it. Yeah. Like they add at the end that he thought that Chester didn't really want to marry his mother. Because the thing with Chester, it seems that he's waiting for the wedding until he gets the promotion so he can afford the wedding. But I'm guessing that they keep pushing the date. I'm putting things together from scraps pretty much. So in Matthew's mind, it just means the guy doesn't want to marry his mother because he keeps pushing it, even though it's because of grown-up reasons.
Yeah, the notion, there is kind of this...
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I don't want to say class struggle because I'm not sure that that's the right way to put it, but there is sort of this like Chester is lower on the totem pole at this company. He's striving for more, wants a promotion.
Haves and haves not, have nots yet.
Yeah.
But it's weird because you would think usually that kind of ends with like getting one up on the haves. Instead, it just Chester kind of becomes one of them. Really?
It's like, yeah. This movie seems like it's going to be a snobs versus slobs comedy.
Yeah.
Yep. With you, it seems like it's going to be Bad News Bears. He's taken this group of unruly girls, but also because the initial impetus is his boss wants him to do this.
Yep.
Like they're like the ultimate like goal is never I want to beat like the prep school, you know, mm-hmm. like the Mighty Ducks is that the Mighty Ducks is like this unruly group of kids. We got to beat the mm-hmm. rich kids. And like it works beautifully because that's a wonderful mm-hmm. trope.
Yeah.
And like,
and with Bombay's boss, like he ends up quitting basically. So you would think that would happen here too.
Yeah. And so this movie like sets all of that up and then fails to like realize it set all of that up and is instead like, I guess this is going to be how he gets close to his stepson. And then mm-hmm. His stepson gets close to the girl he has a crush mm-hmm. on. It's all very like, I don't know. I will say that a number of queer women reached out to me and were like, Vanessa Shaw in that movie is like how I realized there was something up with me.
So, interesting. Yeah. I mean, I actually, you know, Vanessa Shaw, who I was kind of looking at her career because I'm ultimately the only thing I kind of associate with her is Eyes Wide Shut, mm-hmm. Which she's quite good in. And she gets a little bit of a bounce off of that and does sort of a handful of other movies. And I think she's quite talented. And she is good in this. I would say that actually most of the kid actors mm-hmm. are pretty solid. You know what I mean? Like, again, this is a time when, you know, you've got the Mighty Ducks and all these mm-hmm. big kind of kid ensembles. But, you know.
Vanessa Shaw is always good when, like, I see her pop up in things like as an adult. Cause like she showed up in Mad Men too. And I was like, it's Vanessa Shaw. But it's, especially as a kid, she was like one of the hot kids in movies. Like she's the hot girl in Hocus Pocus as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But this is just tangent, but I fucking love How many times in Mad Men, Matt Weiner was like, I'm just going to take this child star. And now they're playing an adult woman who's desperately sad.
Oh, yeah. Well, Edmund's like, how about we just take a bunch of the cast of Jack and Bobby? And I'm like, okay. Yes. I was always disappointed Bradley Cooper didn't show up, too.
Jack and Bobby was like a touchstone for Matt Weiner somehow. Like one of the people I work with now on Yellow Jackets, like, worked on Jack and Bobby. And like, when I found that, I was like, tell me everything. I need to know so much about Jack and Bobby. Because I loved that show.
Yes.
But I mean, and obviously on Mad Men, it starts with Elizabeth Moss, who was a child star, who then, you know, that's her first like adult role. West Wing is like, she's still kind of playing a kid, you know? Yeah. So it's just a weird thing about that show. I always appreciate.
Yeah. This is the time when the 80s is when this starts, I think, in earnest, which is sort of kid actors actually, you know, playing major roles in movies, right? Like, I think the Spielbergian stuff really kind of goes that way. A lot of the things he produces. And then in the 90s, you start to see these Disney films where it's like, you can actually have a whole host of kid actors and then Disney Channel and all that kind of stuff.
I mean, like, the thing that I think switches in the 80s and 90s is it drifts out of Disney, because Disney was always doing that. Mm-hmm. Disney was always like, here's a bunch of kids.
Right.
And like,
that's true.
But like,
here's
some kids. But like, you know, you think about Bad News Bears, which is the template for all these movies. Mm-hmm. That's like a seismic, here's a bunch of fucking kids movie. I don't know.
It is just sort of fascinating. And I would say too, you know, there's a reason for it. It's a solid framework. It's a bucket, you know, your movie is going to fall in, and you just know that it should work. And it's why it's so shockingly inept in this movie, where you're just like, you've got all the pieces here, I guess, for something that could conceivably find, you know, a C+, B- movie, right? And yet they just kind of trip all over themselves because they want the Rodney Dangerfield injection of his kind of gross out humor. It just doesn't work.
The core of every single one of these, like Mighty Ducks, again, a great example. Bad News Bears, a great example, is the coach needs to learn to be a dad.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And like, this movie makes that fucking explicit and then does nothing with it.
Nothing.
It's just like, Rodney Dangerfield needs to learn to be a dad to this kid. And like, that's a great central hook. And then they're just like, I guess it, you know, he, but then
the instead thing, it just has Matthew learning to be a team player.
Yeah.
That's what happens.
Yes.
The moment that I just like realized this movie, you know, I don't think this movie had potential in my brain, but the movie I realized it was going to realize none of it is when he's like, I got a plan. You're great at soccer. And then he's like looking at Matthew with like his bug eyes. And then Matthew goes, no, I will never. And then they do this is a Stan Daniels turn. Is that what that's called? Yeah. And they just cut to him and a girl. There's no persuasion. There's no convincing. All the scenes that would involve them building a relationship, even with this ridiculous premise, are cut out. It's so 100%. Weird.
They cut out scenes like there's the fact that there's no actual scene of Matthew telling what's your name? Vanessa Shaw's character, Kimberly, telling Kimberly what happened, or her being like, what the hell? I confided in you. You were nothing. Again, no one seems to care. When the other scene, it was a boy. And then immediately like, okay, it's fine.
We don't even get a scene of Chester and what's Bess.
She's just there at the game. And then
that conversation, right? Of like, of what the fuck? All of the like unpacking, emotional unpacking of any character arcs are off screen.
Yeah.
It's very strange.
Like, I imagine she's at the game because Matthew convinced her, but like, cause he even says, my mom's not talking to me either. So like, why is she there?
The whole thing's just very strange.
Yeah. And it's also like, okay, so Matthew dresses up a girl at the behest of his future stepfather and everyone's more mad at him. Like, everyone is like, what a great strategy, Chester. Matthew, you should never have gone along with this. It's like, it is how we got, you know, it's just like a weird movie that's sort of an example of how we got such weird sexual attitudes about children and teenagers in the 80s and 90s.
I want to ask sort of a bigger question about the trope of a man dressing up like a woman for jokes, right? Like,
height of comedy.
It is amazing to me that we're still kind of doing it. like we're not doing it to the same extent.
It's you like to do it in the United States, you have to cross a really fucking high bar. To do it in the UK, they still think it's hilarious, which is possibly why they have such a turf.
it's up there, but I guess the question is, I mean, this is 1992, sure, fine, right? Mm-hmm. But when do you think it started being not okay, or people started pushing back on the trope of, isn't it funny this man is dressed up like a woman?
Genuinely, I think it's been the last 10 years. Like, I do feel like
it lasted a while.
I feel like the turning point is the Danish girl. Like, that's for some reason the movie where everybody's like, well, men should, you know, cis men should not.
Especially when they're, it's terrible acting.
Yeah. I mean, that's
why it turned.
Movie, The Danish Girl.
But yeah, like you look at 2 years before that is Dallas Buyers Club, for which Jared Leto wins a fucking Oscar. Now, there haven't been a lot of cross-dressing comedies, you know, since this movie, cross-dressing as a comedic device in the U.S. Sure. It wasn't even that we like thought it was bad. It was just that we like got very tired of it. You know, some like it
hot, hacky, ultimately.
Some like a Hot and Tootsie, like kind of perfected it. And you're like, I guess we're going to go do other things. You know, there's like She's the Man and things like that. And
Mrs. Doubtfire. I mean, it's, you know, that's obviously that a fucking hugely successful movie.
Yeah. But it's, I do think that like people just like got tired of it and thought of it as a hacky device. Mm-hmm. And then in 2015, we all decided we shouldn't be doing this anymore, just like at once.
But I also think there's the aspect, well, which doesn't come into play here, but with black men dressing up as women too, as Cat Williams talked about it, and I don't necessarily agree with everything about, like, you know, the humiliation ritual, but this is, like, this is something that they have, like, Tracy talk about in 30 Rock, basically, having, like, black comedians dress up as women, basically to make them, like, seem, like, less edgy or intimidating. It's like Big Mama's House with Martin Lawrence or something like that. This is like
the Tyler Perry thing.
Yeah. Let's not talk about Tyler Perry. That's a different episode for the podcast. So it's a different kind of context. And I think a lot of it's also steeped in homophobia, that like pushing back against it too, you know?
Yeah. I think that acceptance of cis white gay men became fairly common in the 2000s in the U.S. And though trans people were not like really part of that, it is like, it's sort of like we got lumped in as like, well, you can't make fun of this anymore, right? Like, that's bad because, you know, we can't make fun of cis gay men, which like, we're not cis gay men, but, you know, like, but you do like, I in the pandemic, my wife tried to rewatch How I Met Your Mother, and it just like, there's so many transphobic jokes in that. And like, you forget, like, there's so many transphobic jokes in The Simpsons. Like, you forget how common this was as like a twist. But the specific thing of like, this man has to dress up like a girl to like, and then he gets close to a girl that he falls for, etc. Which, you know, it, again, I think there's a very high bar to cross with that, but like some like it hot is one of my favorite movies of all time, so I don't think you can't do it well, but it is like that specific trope really falls out of favor post Mrs. Doubtfire, and like I can't entirely explain why.
Yeah, it's just kind of because they did it so well, it's kind of hacky. It's like, if you can't excel in it, if you can't do a drive-by fruiting, then don't even try.
But I mean, I think it just I mean, I would argue that there's very few tropes that haven't kind of been beaten to death. Mm-hmm. I think that audiences are just kind of too savvy to it now, that it's like, you know, why are we still doing this? But this movie, again, is right in kind of that time when it felt like this was a hooky, edgy, funny sort of sandbox to play in. It's just, I don't know. It obviously just doesn't work for me.
I think that when the cross-dressing comedy works, it's either nobody comments on it. A lot of British shows are like, here's a man who plays an over-the-top woman, but she is a woman and we never are going to comment on it, you know? Or it's like you discover, like you're learning to accept a certain part of yourself. Like that's what Some Like It Hot is about. Some Like It Hot is like kind of ambiguously queer. Mm-hmm. It's about at the end of that movie, the nobody's perfect line is like, well, you know, they're going to figure this out, these two. And like Tootsie is also about like this guy discovering some aspect of his person that he hadn't allowed himself to access. And like, Mrs. Doubtfire, I guess, is that with like him realizing he wants to be a good dad, but like that's a lower bar to clear. But it's like, this movie is there's nothing in this movie that is like Matthew discovers a thing about himself. And I'm not saying he has to discover he's a girl. He just has to discover that like he likes other people or something. I don't know.
I'm looking here just to see if there's anything that kind of jumps out at me in terms of quote unquote cross-dressing comedies that popped to some degree. I mean, obviously you have Tu Wong Fu, which is sort of just the American Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, which was its thing.
But that is a movie that's specifically about drag and like is.
No, absolutely.
For the 90s, relatively sensitive to it.
Right. And then you have like The Hot Chick, which is the Rob Schneider thing.
The body swap. Yes.
The body swap thing. Then you have White Chicks, which is its own thing. I don't really know what to make of that. You know,
personally think we need more white face in cinema. We need the white chick technology more in cinema.
We should implement that technology more.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, and Albert Nobbs. I don't know.
But again, that's a movie that's trying to be sensitive about like trans people. Like, I don't think it's doing a great job, something. But it's trying.
It's trying something. Know? It is trying something. Let's rate this movie, guys.
We're done talking about ladybugs.
I mean, we could keep talking about it.
We could talk about the rich people drinking champagne at children's soccer games.
No. I genuinely like. Yeah, let's wrap this up because I want to go see Dune.
I also wanted to very briefly talk about the film that we're covering next week. I came into this podcast at a 10. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give it a little bit higher. I'm going to go to 18 because I think I might have been a little bit hard on it.
Yeah.
Where are you, Emily?
Well, I was thinking about today as I was going to bed last night. I was thinking about like, why did I have this involuntary reaction to this? And like, I just sent a string of messages to like one of my best friends who's trans. And she woke up in the morning and responded to me with like, do I need to watch this movie? And I was like, it's so terrible. It's kind of transcendent. And then she said, as like you, I love transphobic media. And I was like, that's when it clicked for me. Cause I was like, the premise of this movie is undergirding so much of the pushback against trans rights in the United States right now. So much of what we're dealing with is like, boys are going to get on girls' teams or they're going to enter women's mm-hmm. spaces and they're going to do that to cause harm or to cheat or whatever. And it's like driven by this underlying misogyny that is like, well, you know, a woman mm-hmm. can never be as good as a man. Therefore, Jonathan Brandis playing on this. And like Ladybugs, I think, is like very much about this specific kid who's very good at soccer until that last joke kind of tanks all of it. But it is like based on this assumption we have as a culture that is ultimately untrue. And ultimately faulty and ultimately both transphobic and misogynistic. And so like, I'm watching this movie that is about like, what is happening to my community at this moment in this country? And it was so brazenly awful in talking about that, I had no reaction but to laugh, because if I hadn't, it would have been like despair. And, you know, anyway, this is to say, I'm going to give this movie a 2 or a 200. Take your pick.
Where does it fall on the queer phobia scale? Did it break the scale? I feel like
it's a 9. Okay. It's a 9. It's not quite a 10, but because I do feel like Jonathan Brandis, bless him, is trying to play the emotional reality. This
he
moment.
Is. Is that
the Leo would have tried game? Too? Is the thing?
Yeah.
Is that your highest queer phobia rating?
I believe it is.
Up there. I think
it's,
it is.
It's yeah. I don't think I've gone
was
higher
one
than
or a 10.
Right. The previous highest was Basic Instinct, which I gave a very enthusiastic 7 with 2 thumbs up.
So Latoya, I'm curious, what do you think your rating for this film would have been as a child, and what do you think it is now?
I mean, before, like, we have to do as a child pre-seeing the Mighty Ducks and post-seeing the Mighty Ducks.
Fair. Okay, that's
although
fair.
I guess I don't love the first Mighty Ducks as much again as D2. I did watch it a lot. I remember being in stitches when he had to keep switching between Matthew and Martha, mm-hmm. and he was just sliding down those stairs. I'm like, this is physical comedy, baby. This is what it is. I don't think it was still like the highest for me as a child. Sure. You know, What did I? Do you know what I gave the other sister? By the way, because I'm like, I should compare it.
I can.
To that.
I can pull that up.
Yeah, we got that. We got a wiki for that.
I got that. Yeah. Let's see. The other sister. I think we all were pretty hard on the other sister, if I remember correctly. Just keep talking while I do this.
I believe. Okay. I think that my wife loved the other sister. Like,
really?
I think that was a movie that for her was a touchstone as a kid.
That is shocking. To
that
me.
Was her touchstone as a kid.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to text.
I think you should rewatch tonight.
I'm confusing it with a different movie.
I think you
just
might.
Just all caps. Let me. Do you love the other sister?
Talking. Yeah. Can you ask her if she's if she loves the other sister? I'm just pulling up the ratings here. Hold on. We'll cut all of this.
Did you love the other sister? I've asked.
Because I'm not.
She said, no, Jesus.
If you made her watch back to back Ladybugs and the other sister.
That's amazing. Okay.
So what movie was it? It was not the other sister.
I don't. I'll have like, it is a movie in that vein, but I don't think it is a movie that is that offensive to. yeah.
So, Latoya, you gave it a 15.
Okay.
I gave it an 8. I gave it a 17. That's where we landed. So,
why?
Where would you fall on Ladybugs, do you think?
The first number that comes to mind is a 2.
Great.
As I told you how special this movie is to me, I'm giving it a 2.
It's, I mean, the thing about, I mean, just to very briefly, the thing that about the other sister that ultimately makes that movie cursed is obviously the performances of Juliette Lewis and Giovanni Ribisi. You can't watch it and not feel just like bad ultimately. Whereas this movie is sort of playing it so fast and loose and is so sort of like overtly a comedy as opposed to the other sister, which is like earnest. I don't know, it's a different thing. But so you're at a 2 now. As a child, where do you think you were as a kid?
I don't know if it would be like, you know, fair. High. Wouldn't be like in the. Let's see how discerning I was as a child. I'm like really trying to like go back to this. Okay, so Heart and Souls is like at 100. So
yep,
this is not close to Heart and Souls. Yep. I'd give it like maybe like 30-40 range, but that's still pretty good. When you're a kid, 30-40 range can be great. So
no, absolutely, and you saw it a million times. So yeah, like it obviously, you know.
It's like my siblings, my younger siblings, they like my brother and sister loved the movie Jack when they were kids, mm-hmm. and they made us watch it all the time, and I hated it. So
I've never seen Jack.
Oh God, famous last words.
You know how like I was telling you about how like, you know, if Taylor Swift did a Jack remake, I would force mm-hmm. myself to like it. It's like Robin Williams was my guy in that at that point in time. And like, I was like, I saw it in theaters and was like, yeah, that was really good. And I've never revisited it because I know it's bad. It's similar to how I saw Vice at a press screening in 2018. It was like, this is the movie America needs right now. And then everyone else hated it. And I've never gone back to it because I'm like, I don't, what would be worse than me realizing I was wrong is if I liked it that much again. If I was like,
oh,
yes,
sure.
You get your finger on the pulse, Adam McKay. Anyway, that's how I felt about whatever it was we were talking about.
Jack, which, Jack. Reminder, Bill Cosby is in that movie.
He is?
Yes.
Jack is, I guess, the second film in the Robin Williams oeuvre of aging in strange ways, Bicentennial Man being the other one, I'm assuming.
Technically Jumanji.
And yeah. That's actually fair. Yeah.
He comes back and he's old.
Yeah, I think that he's like I think that Robin Williams has such irrepressible little boy energy that of course he plays that role a lot. Bicentennial Man is different because he just like lives a long time. I don't think that counts, but Jumanji absolutely does.
Yes.
So next week, I did an episode without Emily. I was sad about it, but I did it on a film called Mr. Saturday Night. A movie where Billy Crystal, it's interesting. Have you seen Mr. Saturday Night? Do you know this movie?
I have not, no.
Basically, Billy Crystal kind of cashed in all of his chips and all of his clout to, direct and star in a movie about a curmudgeonly stand-up comic whose career got away from him, I guess is maybe the way of describing it. Some of the worst old age makeup I've ever seen. Billy Crystal at his most unlikable, which says something, because I don't know that Billy Crystal is the most likable guy in the world, but like it's just such a misguided movie. However, they did make a musical out of it. Emily, have you listened to the songs from this?
I have not. It's Jason. It's one of my favorite composers, Jason Robert Brown. And I am just like, it, of his scores, it did not get the kindest reviews. Phil, you need to listen to his score for the Bridges of Madison County musical, which is a lush, beautiful.
I love that movie.
And it's a beautiful show that deserved better. But Mr. Saturday Night, I did listen to his Honeymoon in Vegas score, and that wasn't great. So.
Latoya, do you have Billy Crystal thoughts?
Nah, he's just, I feel like he was one of those white guys who was always an old white guy, even back in the day. I'm like, he wasn't that old, but like he felt that way. Like, yeah, I'm sure I definitely watched a City Slicker or two back in my youth, but it was not in the rotation.
Emily, we talk about this on the episode, and it was maybe the moment that I wished you were on the most, which was Billy Crystal Oscar host. I'm just kind of, as we wrap this up, what are your feelings about that? Because it does feel like we are now at a place where it seems like Jimmy Kimmel has become kind of the new Billy Crystal, right? Just like a guy who gets it done. The jokes are fine. You know, maybe there's a sprinkling of an edgy joke here or there. Mm-hmm. Why do you think Billy Crystal kind of became the guy? Did you like him as an Oscar host?
I strongly prefer Kimmel to Crystal. I was never a huge Crystal fan. I didn't quite get it. Some of it was I was living in South Dakota. And like the thing about a good Oscars host is they understand the Los Angeles temperament in a way that like when Jon Stewart came in, I thought he did a very good job of hosting the Oscars. But I think the people in the room didn't think that. And the thing about Kimmel and Crystal is like they understand what the people in the room want to hear, but how to build a bridge to the audience. And Crystal's whole shtick just didn't play for me because I didn't understand the reference spot he was in, whereas I do with like Jimmy Kimmel. Mm-hmm. Weirdly, my boomer mom fucking loves Jimmy Kimmel. Like that's so I think that's like, I guess that's he just like has that thing. It's very weird that the guy like I first noticed because of The Man Show is now like this like pillar of our industry.
I always look at him sideways because of that.
It is interesting because like the Billy Crystal thing, he does it a few. I'm trying to remember when like what his hosting like when he did the awards. Do you remember, Emily, what years he was doing them?
Billy Crystal? I feel like he started in like 91. Like he did it like 7 or 8 times, right?
He hosted it a bunch. So he hosted it 90, 91, 92, 93, then 97, 98, 2000, 2004, and then 2012. It was the 2012 one when everyone was like, what are we doing?
Yeah, because he does blackface. Like he does blackface at those awards. He's playing.
I was wondering if I had to bring it up. So,
well, no, it's just like everyone saw that and was like, "What the fuck is this?" And then like boomers were like, "Well, he's doing Sammy Davis Jr. It's funny." And we were like, "It is? I don't think so. I think we should maybe tell Billy Crystal that he can go out into the pasture somewhere."
Yeah, just, like, I mean, it was the moment when I feel like, and the Oscars are still, I mean, I think they're probably just happy that Jimmy Kimmel is good enough, for lack of a better way of putting it, because they were lost in the woods in sort of the late 2000s, early 2010s, when like they couldn't find a person that would do it consistently. So they kept kind of ping-ponging. You had your Chris Rocks and your Ellen DeGeneres, and you had all these different people that were kind of slotted in. And the Billy Crystal thing just felt so desperate.
They should have brought back Hugh Jack. He was so good.
He was great. He was great.
I sent you that Neil Patrick Harris Tony's opening. And like I think that what you want to really get attention, I think Jimmy Kimmel's fine. You know, I like him a lot at what he does. But I think like a big song and dance number is Pretty Unimpeachable, and like mm-hmm. I think we should get back to that mode of Oscar hosting.
I agree.
Back here. Ariana DeBose should host and do an Academy Awards rap that I will have in my head for the rest of my life.
Do Angela Bassett did the thing?
Do the thing,
even if she's not in the room.
You're a genius.
I'm just looking at this list. I didn't know that Jack Lemmon did it as many times as he did. Mm-hmm. Which is interesting. Which is 4 times. Whoopi did it 4 times. Kimmel's now at 4 times. It is just interesting. Billy Crystal, I think, at that moment in the 90s, specifically this, you know, this is 1992, coming off of When Harry Met Sally, City Slickers, he's at a peak of his popularity when he makes this movie. And it's just interesting how Billy Crystal really was sort of this unimpeachable comedy voice through the sort of early, even, you know, most of the 90s. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, I don't really love the guy. I love When Harry Met Sally. I quite mm-hmm, like yeah. City Slickers, but like, it's not because of Billy Crystal, if that makes sense. Do you mm-hmm. know what I mean?
I interviewed him for his one season FX show. I think it was called The Comedians. He did it with Josh Gad. He was just like, I had really liked him in person. Like, he's stars I've interviewed, he's one of the bigger ones that I also was like, oh, you seem like you're probably pleasant to hang out with. But yeah, I don't know that that translates. He's pitched a specific boomer anxiety. I can't hear the frequency, you know.
I 100% is that, for sure. There's also this, like, you know, there are people, he's really hot in what's Running Scared, right? Like, he had this moment when he was kind of like young and quote unquote hot, I guess, but like, he's also just not like a physically appealing person yeah. for me. So there's just like, there's all these things, these weird messages to him. And I really think that if either of you ever, and you shouldn't, watch Mr. Saturday Night, you'll sort of see just a complete lack of understanding of what people like about him. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of crazy to watch.
I've never seen Running Scared, but I just did a Google image search and I'd hit that. Like, that.
So there you have to do it. I have yeah. to look.
No, but what I think is so funny is how many photos are Crystal with his shirt hanging open to show off the moderate, and like Gregory Hines, who has a dancer's body, is yes. wearing a shirt because we can't upstage Billy Crystal.
It is. Now I'm curious.
Oh, wow. Okay. I see the shirtless. You like, got the cum gutters going. Interesting dirtbag look. I see it. I see the vision.
Billy Crystal dirtbag look was a great stand-up special of his. But yeah, it's an interesting thing to watch when, and this has happened, it feels like, numerous times in the kind of history of Hollywood, if you will, of someone at the peak of their powers taking a swing and not connecting with the ball, and you just sort of kind of watch it. It's like a head rolling down a highway. You're just like, whoa, this is a crazy thing.
It is interesting that in this year that so many of these big comedy stars are trying to appeal to kids, Billy Crystal's like, now's my Oscar moment.
This is my chance. LaToya, please plug away. Are there things that people can hear you, see you, read you?
Yes. As Phil said up top, I host a podcast called The Empire Diaries, which is a podcast about the Vampire Diaries and its various spinoffs. We are currently doing season 6 of Vampire Diaries and season 2 of the originals. So I apologize. It's terrible for SEO, the search, but if you put it in quotes, The Empire Diaries, you'll surely find it. I am also currently, hopefully, will be writing about season 3 of The OC for Miles McNutt's Episodic Medium. Just finished season 2 over there. So please go read those because you want to witness me suffer, right? Reviewing season 3 of The OC. I think everyone wants to see that.
The OC pretty, historically flies off the rails, right?
Season 3 is so dour is probably the best way to describe it, and there are some bright spots, but Jesus Christ, it's not going to be fun. So it would be fun for you to read it as I suffer.
Can't wait.
But yeah, you know, I'm on these internet streets, still at Twitter. I will dead name it. I'm sorry, Emily, but I will do it for one thing. I will dead name one thing, and it's Twitter. at LaFergs, LaFergs. And if you see what I'm up to, you see that I should be off the internet. So just give me a job writing for your TV show.
Yes, you're one. Yes, I worked with LaToya on Arden, which that season will get made at some point, I'm assured. I'm no longer working there, but and she's a wonderful, funny, great writer who contributed amazing ideas in the room. And if you are listening to the Ladybugs episode of this podcast and have hiring power in Hollywood, please hire her.
She you hear that I had ideas to make this movie better. So yes. Like I could contribute to your room.
Hire LaToya to run the Ladybugs TV series.
Monkey's paw.
Thank you so much, LaToya, for coming on here to talk about a movie that I kind of didn't really know existed. And I promise you, it's here on record that the next movie you come on for will be a movie you want to come on for and is a good movie.
Okay. We'll see. We'll see about that. Because I can imagine you being like, let's see if we can get lower than a 2 rating from LaToya.
No, I don't. That's the thing. I'm not playing with fire here. I'm just, you know, you said Ladybugs. You jumped at it. I'm like, all right, let's do Ladybugs.
That's not how it happened. Yet again, this is not how it happened.
I will say this. Like, I've gone on other movie podcasts to discuss Stone Cold masterpieces, and I've gone on to discuss Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland. And like, I had way more fun discussing Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland.
I never want to see that movie again.
What was the dance? What's it called?
The Futterwacken?
Yeah, Bill. The Futterwacken. Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't know why I forgot, but yeah, I forgot.
I do that dance now at people's weddings. It's a thing that I do.
That's beautiful and cursed. Thank you again, LaToya. This was absolutely a blast.
Thank you, guys.
We'll talk
soon.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.